Thank you. Good evening. Welcome to Enough Rope. Much like the brain surgery he does every day, my first guest is a challenging, highly complicated individual. A self-described maverick, many patients see him as a miracle worker. Yet to his fellow neurosurgeons, he's a magnet for controversy. To see what makes him tick, let's turn the tables and go inside the mind of Dr. Charlie Tehoe.
Welcome, Charlie.
Thank you. You've just come from a hard day at the brain, is that right?
That's right.
How many operations have you done today?
We just did the one operation on a little girl and took out three, actually a total of 8 tumours out of her brain, but 3 of them were quite large and the rest were relatively small ones.
And how long was that operation?
We started at 7:30, finished at about 2 o'clock, so it's at about five hours, all at 5.5 hours.
Not a particularly long operation?
No.
What's the longest operation you've ever had?
26 hours.
And you have to go all the way through?
I was actually the fellow, and the consultant came in, as in America, at about midnight and asked if I wanted a break, and I said, yeah, that'd be great. And then I went out and had a toilet break, and I was just about to have a drink, and they called me back in again because he'd hit a major bleeder and asked me to go in and take over again. So basically about a 5-minute break, and then I had to take over until about 9 o'clock the next morning.
Wow. Yeah. I've got here well, it's my brain, actually. I took it out just for today. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what you see when you go in there. What do you see when you open up somebody's head?
Well, hopefully you don't see that much brain exposed, because what I've tried to develop in the last few years is a minimally invasive approach to the brain. So we normally, you know, only see a very small portion of any particular part of the brain. Yeah. And through that opening, we then sort of expand outwards and take out whatever needs to be taken out further down. So, you know, it's just basically a very, very small part that we expose at any one time.
Does it have a smell?
No. In fact, the brain has very few senses. It doesn't have pain fibres. You can operate on the brain while the patient's awake, and they don't feel anything at all.
What do you chat to them about at that time?
Just sort of everyday conversation, like the weather and things like that, and try and relax them. And then
you don't say things like, God, you've got a beautiful brain. Love the way you're thinking.
No, but you definitely don't say, oops.
No, no.
That's what you don't say.
Yeah, for sure. What's the oddest thing you've ever found inside someone's head?
Well, there's a thing called a teratoma. It's a benign tumour. You're born with them. They're often in the midline of the brain, and they contain all different parts of the body, like hair and teeth and bone. So I've actually found a finger inside the brain, a fully formed finger with cartilage, bone, flesh and a fingernail. It was doing that.
So, when you look at the human brain, are you sort of awed by the majesty of this complex thing, or is it just your workplace?
Oh, no, it's absolutely awe-inspiring, because there's so much that's undiscovered about the brain. It is fascinating. You know, we have more than 7 billion neurons in the brain, yet we only know what about 10% of them do. So there's all this brain matter, and we lop it out every day, and there's really no discernible difference in the patient. You've taken a big hunk of their brain out. And so, you know, we have yet to discover what those parts of the brain actually control.
And yet you said if you make a slip, you said oops before, you can profoundly affect the quality of somebody's life. What can happen if it goes wrong?
Yeah, so there are eloquent and non-eloquent parts of the brain. The non-eloquent parts of the brain can be operated on with relative impunity. The eloquent parts of the brain, it's sub-millimetre accuracy. I mean, if you just go 1 or 0.5 millimetre too far, you can paralyse someone, or you can kill them or put them on a ventilator forever.
Things do go wrong sometimes. You talked about a bleeder before. What happens when something goes wrong?
You've got to maintain a certain confidence that you're doing the best you can do. I mean, if you operate on a little child and they wake up paralysed or you kill them, I mean, you've got to live with that. So unless you have a certain amount of self-confidence and you can't live with it, you just, you know, you'd go to the pack and you just wouldn't be able to cope with operating the next day on someone else.
Have you ever had a moment where your confidence has quailed?
I've operated on patients and the outcome hasn't been so good, and I felt, you know, maybe I shouldn't have done that. Maybe I was being a little bit arrogant. Maybe I thought I could help that patient and, in fact, you know, all I've done is make their life a little bit more miserable and I haven't helped them at all and they're going to die anyway from their malignancy.
How do you end up getting to a point like that? What's that process?
I mean, you know, you've operated on this little child, things have gone badly, then you've got to go out and speak to the parents, you know, straight after the operation. So you've got to be composed and you've got to actually have thought about it internally that you've done the right thing and things just didn't turn out right. So you've actually got to come to grips with yourself very, very quickly.
You've described neurosurgery as the most emotionally taxing specialist medicine there is. Can you take me through the emotional extremes, what you experienced?
Well, unfortunately, about 70% of all brain tumours are malignant. So that means that the patients are going to die eventually. So that means that when you meet the patient, you develop a relationship with them, they give you permission and the great honour of operating on their brain, their very soul, and then you look after them in the post-operative period and you meet their families and you develop this incredible relationship that eventually they're going to die. Or, hopefully, there are some that survive, but unfortunately the majority will die. So, and that is incredibly devastating. I mean, it's so upsetting.
You bring them into your life, don't you? They come into your home.
I do, and I've been criticised for that. In fact, I failed my neurosurgery exams three times, and I think that's one of the reasons why I haven't been quite accepted by the fraternity now. Developing these relationships with the patients is great. The patients love it, I love it, but it gets emotionally incredibly draining and taxing and tiring. Yet if you maintain a bit of a barrier and that aloofness, then it's not as emotionally taxing and you don't... And I think your professional life is extended because of that. So in some ways it's a self-preservation technique.
In its own way, it's no different to the sort of preparation you put into an operation. It's a professional approach.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So I can see the argument for it. I just haven't been able to adopt it, that's all.
I read you once talking about after one young girl had died after an operation, that you found yourself sobbing uncontrollably in front of your family.
Yeah.
Why that particular case, do you know?
Oh, she was the age of one of my own daughters. She was all children are beautiful, but she was just beautiful. And her parents were overseas at the time that she deteriorated rapidly. Well, she was dying and I had to operate on her pretty urgently. So I didn't manage to develop rapport or a relationship with the family, with the parents. So I operated on her, saved her life, and she did very well. She woke up after surgery, neurologically good. And then 2 weeks later, after visiting Sydney and looking pretty good, she just dropped dead. And to this day, we don't quite understand why it happened. And, you know, she wore these Chinese pyjamas just for me because I was Chinese. And, you know, I mean, she was just delightful. You couldn't think of a more beautiful person. And I could see my own child in her. And I think that's why it affected me so badly.
Can you tell me a bit about the euphoria that can come with what you do? Because there are patients that exceed expectations, aren't there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, the euphoria is great. And that happens frequently. So, you know, I mean, I'll just give you some examples. A young mother, two children, operated on four times by several very senior neurosurgeons all around the country. Tumour will not go away, keeps coming back. Try radiotherapy, doesn't work. Chemotherapy doesn't work. Sent home to die. And she wants to make a video so her children remember her because they're young. So she does this video, and then she sees me on TV, decides to send me her x-rays. She comes down, I take the tumour out. And, you know, that was about 9 years ago, and I just discharged her from my care just a few weeks ago. She's cured, and she was facing, she was on her deathbed, essentially.
When you say cured, you mean cured?
Yeah, she's cured. She's got a tumour that's curable. Mm. So,
Well, that must feel fantastic.
Oh, it's a great feeling.
Let's talk about some of the things you do to deal with the stress of your life. You play the bagpipes?
Not well, but yes, I play the bagpipes.
Can anyone tell the difference?
You get on well with my wife. She doesn't like that much.
That's but, what I'll joke. The definition of a gentleman is someone that can play the bagpipes but chooses not to.
No, I think they're beautiful instruments. It's a beautiful instrument, beautiful sound.
You're a black belt in karate?
Well, black belt in karate. Mm-hmm. I did that for many, many years. I still do it. I keep very physical, so I do a lot of kayaking and running, jumping. And
motorbiking still. Tell me about your bike.
I have a very fast bike. I love speed. And I had a fast bike when I was a young fella. And all my biker friends from those days have all progressed and matured, and now they're riding BMWs or driving cars. But I've still got... someone didn't like that comment. But I've still got one of those very fast Japanese bikes, you know.
But always within the speed limit.
No. not within... I mean, I should ride within the speed limit, but no, it's very hard. You know, to ride within the speed limit with a Fireblade 900, you have to be doing first... It has to be in first gear. And even in first gear, you're mostly out of the speed limit. Mm.
So you're out of your driveway at about 200 kilometres an hour, yes. And what's the thrill when you're there going at warp speed?
Yeah, that's the thrill. The warp speed is the thrill, yeah. It's, I guess it's living life on the edge. I kind of like challenges, and I like, I like the challenge of trying to stay alive on a motorbike, 200 k's an hour.
Is part of the reason you push yourself like this is because you see so much mortality that it's, okay, I'm going to take the most of life while I can.
Yeah, that is absolutely the reason. I mean, I think that's the reason I'm such a happy person as well, because, you know, everyone says, you know, how can you be happy when you've got people dying around you all the time? And, I mean, that's what makes me happy. I mean, it's so easy to be happy and so easy to appreciate what you've got when every day you see someone come in with a brain tumour who's going to die from it, or who does die from it, and, you know, you're complaining about your hemorrhoids, or, you know, you're complaining about the neighbour parking in your spot. It's just crazy. I mean, people are dying from brain tumours in the prime of their lives, with leaving young kids or leaving, you know, siblings and loved ones. And we're angry. We're angry about someone pushing in front of us at the traffic lights, or, you know, some surfer stealing your wave. It's absolute bullshit. Mm-hmm. We should be embracing life and being happy and trying to make life better for people, and, you know, get the big picture.
Can you just have volunteers come in and operate with you to sort of get that sense of perspective? Dabblers, neurosurgical dabblers. You said that when you graduated from a university that you pissed off so many people that no one would offer you a job. And this is a thread in your career. In fact, one doctor said that you would be employed at his hospital over his dead body.
Yes.
What is it about you that people have difficulty with?
Oh, gee. I wish I knew. Because if I knew, I'd try and change it.
What do you reckon it is?
Well, I actually rehearsed this answer. <'Cause I'm not. laughs> But having rehearsed the answer, I mean...
Well, it's interesting you'd even rehearse it. You were so sure...
Well, yeah, because everyone asked me. Everyone asked me the same question. Why do they hate you? Mm. And I used to say, oh, they don't really hate me. But they do. Mm. And
they being?
They being the people that find me so threatening. And I think that small minority find me threatening because I am nonconformist. I openly admit that I'm nonconformist, and I've always been nonconformist. And I think some people find have a problem with that. Mm. Genevieve, my wife, has got a pretty good perspective on things, and she thinks that they can't accept me because the day they accept me is the day they have to accept that they've sent a lot of people to their graves. Because if I can take out tumours that they can't take out, and they don't accept that, and they keep sending those people to their graves, then they would never be able to live with themselves, surely.
What is it that you do that others won't?
I think I give people hope, the same sort of hope that I would want someone to give to me. So if I was still enjoying life and someone told me I had a brain tumour that was inoperable, but I had young children and I wanted to see them grow up, even if it's only for a few more months, and someone else said to me, well, actually, I can operate on it. I might be able to buy you some time. I might not. You might be paralysed after surgery. It may be a total waste of time. You may still die within the next few days or weeks, but I'm willing to give it a shot. I'd go with him, you know, and that's what I do to my patients. I say, if I was you, or if you were my wife, or if you were my child, how would I want someone to treat you? And you know, so I sort of self-select my patients. Patients who don't like that don't come and don't have surgery, and patients who like the sound of that will have surgery.
And how often does that go wrong?
I don't know what the percentage is, but it would be at least 5 to 10% of my patients have an adverse outcome where, you know, I haven't extended their life, or I've extended their life, but I've extended their life at a huge cost.
Why do you think hope, or the question of false hope, is a bone of contention within your profession?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but it shouldn't be. I mean, there's no such thing as false hope. I mean, hope is hope. You can make false promises, and I think that's very bad. But again, you can't make too many false promises without being sued. If you're going to go around telling people you're going to save them and you don't, there's going to be a few angry people around.
There is one argument which says that sometimes hope for the patient is not the best thing for the family, in that there reaches a point where it's best for the patient to understand that it's time to get things in order and say goodbye, and to hold out hope is in fact not a good thing for the family.
Yeah, I know what you mean, but no, I'm the patient advocate. I'm not the family advocate. Mm. And I think that's the difference. As a patient advocate, I've got to do what I feel is best for the patient, even if the family don't want me to do it. And that's happened many times, where the family go, you know, OK, we'll take you to see Dr. Teo, but, you know, you're going to die, you know. I mean, they don't say that, but you know, you can see it in their eyes. Mm. And when they come into the room, you can see that they don't really like me and what I'm saying to the family member. So the patient, however, wants to live, and the patient comes and sees me and says, you know, I want you to operate because I'm willing to take that 5% risk that I could live I could be cured or I could live for a long time. And you can see the family going, oh, God, gee, you know, you're going to put us through this, and it's more pain and suffering, and we've already been through it twice before. But again, I've got to be... And it works the other way too, you know. I've had families come in wanting me to operate on their loved ones because they love them and they can't handle the fact that they may be dying soon. But you can see in the eyes of the patient that, you know, I've had it. You know, I don't want to fight this cancer anymore. I'm exhausted. I've had a good life. I'm not enjoying life now. Please let me go. And you can see them begging. And then I've got to be the patient advocate. Then I've got to try and convince the family not to go ahead with surgery and not to keep pushing it.
In 2003, you resigned from your professional body, the Neurosurgeons Society of Australia, right. Neurological Society of Australia. Why resign?
Well, it wasn't a resignation. The president of the society was trying to get rid of me and was writing pretty nasty letters about me. And I thought, well, bugger it. Why do I want to join a society that's actually trying to get me deregistered?
So. But it's so interesting to me. I think we should go to this letter because it followed your appearance on 60 Minutes last year. Mm. And it says, while you talked about no tumour being inoperable, they say, while this may be true, whether a tumour is inoperable or not is a matter of opinion regarding the potential risks of brain injury, stroke or death weighted against the potential benefits of the surgery. Classifying a brain tumour as inoperable is not a sign of fear, incapability or lack of competence. Why were they, do you think, so sensitive to your suggestion that no brain tumour is inoperable?
I don't mind the fact that they call a tumour inoperable.
Mm.
If they find that the tumour is inoperable, they've got their good reason for it. Maybe, for all we know, the last 10 tumours they did like that, they all died. So it's actually good that they look at a tumour like that, say it's inoperable, and do the right thing, what they think is the right thing by the patient. So they might think that I'm bad-mouthing them for that. I have never bad-mouthed them for that. The only thing that I find abhorrent and unacceptable is the fact that they say to the patient then, OK, no one can operate on this tumour. Oh, but we've seen the guy down in Sydney called Dr. Teo. What do you think about him? Oh, are you kidding? You know, and you should hear the things they say to it. They say things like, you know, if you go to Sydney, you never expect to come back to this hospital. We won't look after you again.
If they go to see you.
If they come and see me. That's what I said to a little boy in New Zealand who was going to this children's hospital. OK, you can go to Sydney, but don't expect that you can ever come back to this hospital again. And another person up in Queensland. OK, you go down to Sydney, you should move down there because we won't accept you back here at this hospital again.
Have you often heard stories like this about you?
Oh, 3 or 4 times a week. Mm. You know, so many people ask me, why? Why is it? I mean, why is it that they don't like what you're doing, they don't like you, and they're trying to stop patients? You know, I just don't know. I mean, what is it? I mean, I don't know. I don't know what it is. I know why this program's called Enough Rope, because I am going to hang myself here. You
know? I don't know. Look, it's a question you've been asking yourself, so let's see if we can get to the bottom.
Okay. Okay, so when an athlete wins an event that he's very, very good at, the commentator then asks him, you know, well, how did you go? And he goes, well, I swam really well, or I played really well. So-and-so put up a good fight, but, you know, in the end, I was a better player. And no one blinks, no one turns an eyelid to that. I mean, everyone accepts the fact that this person is a better player, better swimmer, better runner. As a neurosurgeon, if I went out there and said, you know, well, Andrew, you know, I was really in good form today. I had good technical skill and I was focused and, you know, I'm a better surgeon. Wow, you can't do that because, again, that disparages the opposition. So if Charlie Teo says I'm a better surgeon, what does it say about them? That they're a worse surgeon? You know, so you can't say that. So instead I've pussyfooted around a little bit. Over the years I've gone, because I don't want to say I'm a better surgeon, so I say, okay, so I use better techniques and I've got fantastic technology and, you know, I've got a great team and all those things are true.
Isn't it the suggestion of better techniques the thing they're cavilling at, though?
Because yes, it is.
What you do is on the medical benefits schedule. It's widely available as a technique.
Yeah, but I'm a great surgeon. Mm. I am great at what I do. I'm a fan. You know, I can take out tumours that other people can't take out. I don't know how I do it, but I do it. And but I can't say that because it just sounds like, you know, well, I'm fantastic and they're not so good or they're mediocre.
It's interesting. Let me say it, they're
not mediocre. I mean, you know, let me tell you about this guy that's just retired. He was my mentor. I worshipped him. And he was a great neurosurgeon, the best I've ever seen in the world. The little girl that I operate on today, he tried to take that tumour out and couldn't take it out. He tried 4 times and couldn't take it out, and I got the whole thing out.
And why can you?
I don't know. I mean, I have the qualities that I look for in other surgeons. You know, I have dogged perseverance. I will not give up. And I have amazing tenacity where, you know, I can not feel well or blood can be pouring out and the brain can be starting to swell and everyone else around me is panicking and I can stay totally focused on that tumour and just keep working at it and working at it and I won't let it beat me.
One of the things they said in that letter, they referred quite pointedly to, they said the majority of surgeons don't publicly promote their surgical successes. You seem to have broken an unwritten rule here.
Yes.
That you do not publicise yourself. Why do you like publicity? Why do you seek publicity?
So, on the record, I've never sought out publicity.
But you've accepted the opportunity.
Yeah, I accept the opportunities. Mm. You know, you called me, I accepted. I could have easily rejected it.
Sure.
I could have rejected 60 Minutes, I could have rejected Australian Story. Mm. But there are very good reasons why I don't. The first is that, just think about this, when this guy was in his hotel room crying because his 14-year-old son in Perth had just been sent home to die on a morphine infusion. The father's can't get home that night. He's crying. He sees me on TV in Melbourne. He writes to me and goes, well, he rings me up and goes, is there any chance you could operate on my son? Okay, so I operate on his son, take the tumour out. It wasn't malignant. They got it wrong. It was benign. I got it all out. He's now, you know, 8 years later, living a perfectly normal life. Now, if it wasn't for... If it wasn't for the TV program, that guy would never have seen me or heard about me. And for every time I'm on TV, there comes a whole heap of patients that hear about me, and I can do something for them.
It's so interesting. It's one of the... You were once described in a written complaint about you as unsurpassably arrogant. And you yourself have said that your great regret is that you never found a way quite to get on with the Sydney Children's Hospital. And in fact, your office said that in 7 years you never got a referral from them. There's no doubting your skill or your passion or anything like that. Is the issue your bedside manner with your fellow professionals?
Yes. The simple answer is yes. The complicated answer is that some people find it very hard to hear the truth. And, you know, you can say the truth in a very diplomatic way, or you can say you're an arsehole. And I do the latter. And I... So, you know, I make no excuses for that. That's me. And, you know, some people are good at some things and bad at other things. Well, I'm good at neurosurgery, but bad at diplomacy. I've tried, Andrew. I've even had coaching lessons.
Yeah?
Yes. The CEO of the Children's Hospital is a very good man. Mm. He's actually a good friend of mine, and we were registrars together. And he said, Charlie, we've got to get you accepted at this hospital, so I'm going to coach you to be diplomatic. So he came along to a few of the meetings where I'd get up and go, you know, you're crazy. That I can take that tumour around, you know. And he'd go, okay, this is what you should say. And he gave me these lessons and, you know, oh, you know, I'm sure that, you know, you're right in most circumstances, but, you know, in this very rare circumstance, maybe you should possibly, you know. And so I did all that and it still didn't work. Because they could see through me. Yeah. They could see that it was all an act and, you know. I mean, they are my two failings. My two failings are that I have no diplomacy. Mm. And I cannot lie. I have to tell the truth. And that's why it was terrible to accept this invitation to come on. I knew that you would get the truth out of me.
Yeah.
And,
but I would so love to see you as Prime Minister.
And I...
we'd be entertained for a week and at war win too. I think it'd be fantastic.
That's right.
You also have great skill and great passion. The Cure for Life Foundation, your stated aim is to try and find a cure for brain cancer, the incidence of which is increasing. Might I inquire, a mobile phone has anything to do with that in your view?
In my view, yes, but not scientifically, no. Mm. If you look at the science on mobile phones and the link with brain cancer, it is quite compelling, but there's no double-blinded studies, there's no placebo-controlled studies, etc., etc. There's really no science to it. There's an association. And the association is quite compelling. I think the scariest thing is that we know that when you give radiation for cancer to the brain, you can develop brain cancer from the radiation. So we know that. We know that radiation causes cancer. But it takes about 10 years for it to develop. So we know that EMR, electromagnetic radiation, is going to take at least 10 years to create brain tumours, and possibly longer, 15, 20 years. So if you look at the literature and just pull out the studies that have followed their patients for more than 10 years, it becomes really, really compelling, the link. Personally, I think there probably is.
Do you use a mobile?
Yeah, but I always put it on loudspeaker. Mm. So, you know, hello, wait 1 minute, go outside, put it on loudspeaker.
No, I just put mine over the outside of the room and shout.
Yeah, that's
right. Haven't heard a thing someone said for 4 years, but there you go. How is the search going for a cure for brain cancer?
It's going very well. Yeah, it's going very well. You know, once the human genome was mapped, it makes sense that once you know what's normal, it's so easy to tell what's abnormal. So now we can do molecular studies on all the tumours and we can start to find the common link. The bad thing about brain cancer is that it's a very heterogeneous cancer. Meaning there's many different types of cells. There's no one uniform cancer cell. So it's going to be extra hard for brain cancer, but we've made some pretty strong advances in the last two or three years.
You're 51.
Mm.
You were recently diagnosed with diabetes.
Pre-diabetes, yeah.
You've described what you do as a fast sprint. It's a fast sprint profession,
yes.
Emotionally very taxing. How long do you think you see yourself doing this?
You know, not very long. When I was in my 40s, I still felt pretty invincible. I had no ailments. I was climbing mountains. But I must say, in the last couple of years, I haven't felt so invincible. It's taking its toll, and the diabetes is just one thing, but a bit of arthritis. My vision's not as good as it used to be, and so, I mean, I can still... just want to reassure my patients that I can still
just a lot of bookings being cancelled.
Yeah,
right,
that's right, right now, yes. Right now. But no, it's not so much the physical anyway. It's the emotional. Mm. I'm finding it pretty hard now. I think I'll only be around for another five years or so. Yeah.
Well, I enjoy your passion very much, Charlie Teo. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew.